Well, I'm thankful to Mark for leading the first part of the service tonight, and so I want to turn you to that passage that he read to us. So from 1 Samuel chapter 24, 1 Samuel chapter 24, we're making our way through the life of David on Sunday evenings, and we've come to this chapter, how to deal with your enemies. Biblically, that's the title for tonight. How to deal with your enemies. That, in many ways, is what we're taught in this chapter. And it's not something that's simply an Old Testament issue. It's also important in the New Testament as well. So how do we react to those who wrong us? How do we react to those who tell lies about us? How do we react to those who've crossed us, who've put us down, who've spoken against us, who've caused us misery and distress, perhaps? How do we deal with them? How do you deal with that person at work who always seems to have it in for you? How do you deal with that person at work, the boss who seems to treat you badly, that colleague that talks about you, and it's always trying to get one up on you, perhaps? Well, how do you deal with that neighbor who's causing you trouble, or that family member who's acted in some way that's had such a negative impact on you, or whatever it might be? Or how do you respond to that person in the church who's upset you? Well, we might not call them our enemies as such, but the temptation is to want to get our own back. Temptation is to want an opportunity to come where we can give them a bit of their own medicine. Let them know how it feels. Well, here in this chapter, we have a striking example, don't we, of how we should deal with our enemies, with those who mistreat us. Now, how David deals with Saul is even more striking given the context of the whole of 1 Samuel. Now, we only took up 1 Samuel partway through to look at the life of David, but the whole book is covered in blood, and we can put it like every page has got blood on it. I mean, it's even before David turns up, there's battles and death and evil and sin and all its consequences. And then we've seen, haven't we, since David's come along, there's spears and stones flying everywhere. There's battles, there's death, there's extermination. Life seems very cheap in many ways in 1 Samuel. And then we have this. David deals in this way with Saul. Now, of course, let's be straight. David has had no difficulty in dealing with God's enemies, has he? He's had no difficulty in bringing God's judgment on Goliath and on others. But here is David dealing personally with somebody who's dealt a personal enemy, if you like. And it's very, very different, isn't it, how he deals with them. So I want us to think about this for a little while this evening. We've got four headings. Look, the background, the grounds of the revenge, and then the opportunity, the chance for revenge, and then the decision, I will not take revenge, and then the reasoning why David doesn't do that. So let's think about those things first of all. So first of all, the background, the grounds for revenge. Let me just remind you briefly what Saul has done to David and what he's tried to do. I mean, he's returned, hasn't he? We've seen this. He's returned David's amazing loyalty and service with what? With jealousy and with envy and with hatred. We've seen all that David's done for Saul. He's put his life on the line in battle on behalf of Saul as Saul's servant. He's served the king, and yet Saul has rewarded it with bitterness and with anger and with hatred. He's spoken evil of David. He's slandered him. He's accused him of treason. He's made him out to be an enemy of the state, an enemy of Israel. He's generally bad-mouthed him to whoever he could. In a sense, he's destroyed David's life, hasn't he? I mean, the difficulty is for us, we know the end of the story, don't we? But let's try and forget the end of the story. You know, David's life is in ruins at this moment, isn't it? He's had to leave his home. He's had to leave everything he's had. His whole life has been turned upside down. Saul's actions have ruined David's life. He's attempted on several occasions to kill David. He's thrown spears at him. He sent men to ambush him. He sent him out on missions with the clear hope that he's going to die on them. He sent choice men to attack him. And now he's arriving with 3,000 of his elite soldiers to try and get David. That's what Saul's done. All unjustified, all uncalled for. I mean, if anyone ever had a right to be aggrieved, if ever anyone had a right to be bitter and angry and want some revenge, it's David, isn't it? Now, I don't think many of us have been quite so provoked as that, have we? I haven't said any of us, because some of you here tonight have been provoked in some serious ways. But most of us, I think, considering David here, perhaps put some of our gripes in perspective. I mean, I don't think, have you had anyone try to kill you or ruin your life or drive you from your home? That's what David had. So there's the background, the grounds for revenge. I mean, if Saul gets up here and swipes, if David gets up here and swipes Saul's head off, I mean, we wouldn't be surprised, would we? So that's the background, the grounds for revenge. Now the opportunity, the moment for revenge. So at the beginning of this chapter, we see, don't we, that suddenly David has an opportunity to get his own back for revenge. So Saul hears, doesn't he, that David is in the wilderness of En-Gedi. That's verse 1. And so he takes 3,000 chosen men from all Israel. And he goes. They go to this place called the Rocks of the Wild Goats. This apparently is an area that was suitable for wild mountain goats and not much else beside. Apparently there are a great number of large, deep caves in this area. It would have been an ideal place to hide for David and his men. Well, as he's searching the area, then Saul goes into one of these many caves, we're told in verse 3, to attend to his needs. Literally, it is the Hebrew is to cover his feet. Apparently, the expression in Hebrew is a Hebrew euphemism, a bit like we might say he went to spend a penny, which is why the ESV has to relieve himself. But I think it also can be used of sleeping as well. I think Saul goes into to attend to his needs, to have a rest as well. I think that's probably what we have here. It's quite hard to cut off a bit of... Anyway, I'm not going to go any further for that. Now, if we're reading this for the first time, we might go, why are we being told that we don't need this detail about Saul's sort of personal needs, until the writer takes us to the back of the cave in the dark, and we see David and his men hiding in the back of the cave, and suddenly we see what's happened, that Saul has chosen the one cave that David and his men are hiding in, and he doesn't know. And suddenly the tables are turned. Up until now, it's David who's been on the back foot, hasn't it? It's been David who's the underdog. And Saul's held all the cards, hasn't he? And now suddenly it's all up turned around. And David has got his moment and the boot is on the other foot. Sometimes if we've been wronged by someone, we long. We long for an opportunity, don't we, like that? If we let it dwell in our hearts, if we let bitterness, we can imagine the situation. We go through what we would do, how it would happen. And perhaps you're all shocked, and I'll have to resign tomorrow. But you know, they have that. That's a temptation, isn't it? When we're wrong, when someone's said something to us or done something, and we think about, this is what would happen, and we sort of live it out in our minds, and it all goes well for us, doesn't it? And we get our bit of revenge. We have to be careful, don't we, about harbouring and dwelling on ways we've been wronged and imagining how we would get our revenge. Well, David doesn't have to imagine, does he? Because the opportunity's come. And surely it's his time to kill Saul. I mean, think about what would encourage David to do so. So providence would seem to point to it, wouldn't it? I mean, of all the caves that Saul has chosen, He chooses the one that David and his men are hiding in. Surely that's not by accident, is it? You know, surely this is the providence of God. This is God delivering Saul into David's hands. This is God giving David the kingdom. Surely David can hear God speaking in this providence. Finish him off. Finish him off. Certainly added to that, friends encouraged it, didn't they? I mean, David's men, they can't believe that David's good fortune. They're all interpreting God's providence in this way, aren't they? Look at verse 4. Then the men of David said to him, "This is the day of which the Lord has said to you, 'Behold, I will deliver your enemy into your hand, that you may do to him as seems good to you.'" This is the day. They're having a little dance in the back, aren't they? This is the moment. They're all for David sneaking up behind Saul and thrusting him through with a sword, aren't they? They're all there. Go on, go on. I mean, as far as they're concerned, they're reading providence that way. This is the moment. This is the Lord's doing. Verse 10, look down to verse 10. When David comes out and tells Saul how he hasn't killed him, he says, "How they urged me to kill you." They're all there going, "Come on, get on with it." So, providence would seem to point to it. Friends encouraged it. Human nature would desire it, wouldn't it? I mean, there's in fallen human nature that desire for revenge, that love to get our own back. If someone does something to us, we want to do it back. And Saul, and in David, in his old sinful nature, there's still going to be that desire for revenge. All that he's done to me, all that he's put me through, all the hurt, all the pain, all that I've had to bear because of him, now is my chance. Couldn't you? That would be there for me, for sure. And then actions seem to justify it as well, don't they? I mean, if I don't kill him, he's going to kill me. It's either me or him. I mean, all that Saul has done or intends to do would seem to justify David sneaking out from the back and thrusting him through. It's just a matter of justice, isn't it? And then the promises of God seem to warrant it. Hadn't the Lord promised David that he'd be king? Hadn't he sent Samuel to anoint him? Hadn't God rejected Saul as king? Surely David is only bringing about what God intends. So all these factors seem to be encouraging this moment for David to take his revenge and deal with Saul. So we've got the background. The grounds for revenge. And we've got the opportunity, the chance. Here we are. And then we've got the decision. I will not take revenge. So David creeps quietly out from the back of the cave. And we're waiting, aren't we? If we don't know the story, we're waiting for the thrust of the swords. But instead of killing Saul, David instead secretly cuts off the corner of his rope. Perhaps he's taken off, laid it on the ground. Perhaps he's asleep. Somehow David manages to do that. And he refrains, in other words, from killing him. And he lets the opportunity go. And not only does David not kill Saul himself, he stops his men from killing him too. Look at verse 7. So David restrained his servants with these words and did not allow them to rise up against Saul. Now, there's a real strength in the Hebrew here, apparently. He's having to hold them back. There's a heated, whispered argument going on in the back of this cave about, this is madness, David. This is your opportunity. Do it. And David not only has to restrain himself, he has to restrain his men as well. And it takes all his powers to do so, to stop them going and doing his dirty work for him. So what do we have here? We have a classic case of someone not returning evil for evil, but overcoming evil with good. What's the Bible's teaching when it comes to how we're to treat our enemies? Well, let's turn to Matthew, will we? Will you with me? To Matthew chapter 5. Turning to the Sermon on the Mount. We're now with Jesus. in the Sermon on the Mount, we're listening to him, Matthew chapter 5 and verse 43. Let me read from verse 43 to verse 48. You have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies. Bless those who curse you. Do good to those who hate you. Pray for those who spitefully use you and persecute you, that you may be sons of your Father in heaven. For he makes his sun shine on the evil and on the good, and sends rain on the just and on the unjust. For if you love those who love you, what reward have you? Do not even the tax collectors do the same? And if you greet your brethren only, what do you do more than others? Do not even the tax collectors do so? Therefore you shall be perfect, just as your Father in heaven is perfect. Wow, that is some teaching, isn't it? Of course, the truth is we're all happy generally to love those who love us, to be kind to those who are kind to us, to treat well those who treat us well, to invite those around who invited us around. But Jesus says, that's not exactly amazing, is it? I mean, you don't go patting yourself on the back for that. Even the tax collectors who've sold their souls for money do that. So what are believers? What are we to do as believers? To those who curse us, to those who speak evil of us, to those who hate us, to those who spitefully use us and persecute us. Well, the first answer is we're not to treat them in the same way. We're not to repay evil for evil. That's the temptation, isn't it? To curse back, to hate them back, to be spiteful to them. We're not to do that. But it's not simply negative, is it? I mean, it's not simply that we're not to do the same back. It's gloriously positive. But we're to do the opposite. If sometimes someone offends us, upsets us, does something wrong to us, and we say, well, I'm not going to give them what they give back. I'm not going to be like them. I'm not going to stoop to their level. I should just ignore them. You know, I'll just keep out of their way. I'll pretend they don't exist. I'm not going to hate them, but I'm not going to love them either. But that's not what Jesus says here, is it? We're to love them. We're to bless them. We're to seek to do them good. We're to pray for them. We're to treat them in the opposite way. If they speak evil of us, we're to speak well of them. If they wrong us, we're to be kind to them. If they persecute us, if they curse us, we're to pray for them. And when we're like that, what are we like? We're like our Father in heaven. That's what Jesus says, isn't he? I mean, think about this village today. I mean, I'll apply it to you in a moment, but I mean, in this village today, how many people, I wonder, have taken God's name in vain and taken Jesus' name in vain and mocked the very idea of God, perhaps. And yet the sun shone today, and the spring flowers are out, and the goodness of God is seen in every way, because God is good to everybody. And he sends the sun and the rain on the just and the unjust. And who are we tonight? We were enemies of God's, and God has loved us and sent his son for us. While we were yet sinners, while we were enemies, Christ died for us. And we're called to be like him, aren't we? We're called to love and be gracious, to treat our enemies in that way. And what a witness to God's grace when we love our enemies. What an example of the gospel. When we can live and act like that. What a testimony. At work, if you refuse to badmouth that person who badmouths you, and instead to speak well of them, when you don't respond to the boss perhaps as they treat you, and you're gracious and you're kind and you're hardworking and you do the opposite and you overcome evil with good. I mean, that's the gospel, isn't it? Lived out. That's a sign. Here are people who are different. Here are people who've been shown a love that's different and now are displaying a love that's different. And let's not pretend it can't happen in church, that we'll never have to put these things into practice in church, because people will grieve us and sin against us. And what are we to do? How are we going to respond? So we got the background, the grounds for revenge, and the opportunity, the chance for revenge, and the decision, I will not take revenge. David lives out Jesus' teaching 1,000 years before Jesus gives it. And then we've got the reasoning. Why does David not take revenge? Let's look a bit further at what David does and why he does it. So David, back in Samuel now, David cuts off the corner of the robe of Saul. But then in verse 5, look, having done it, he's greatly troubled that he's cut off the corner of his robe. His heart troubled him. His conscience is pricked. Now, I think that's quite amazing, really, isn't it? I mean, if that had been me, I'd been feeling extremely pleased with myself that I'd been noble enough not to kill David and just done that instead to him. What a fine chap I am for doing that and acting in that way. But David feels bad for doing that, doesn't he? His conscience is troubled, even with spoiling the king's robe. Even in showing him that discourtesy, he cuts off his robe. The Lord, and he says to his men, verse 6, the Lord forbid that I should do this thing to my master, the Lord's anointed, to stretch out my hand against him, seeing that he is the Lord's anointed. He's troubled, verse 5, because he cut Saul's robe. So in spite of the way that Saul has treated David, he still considers him to be his king. He still speaks of him as his master. He still speaks of him as the Lord's anointed, worthy to be respected. And therefore he's troubled even with cutting off the corner of his robe. Wow, he's got a high view of Saul, hasn't he? Even though he's treated him in such a way. I think we can apply that, can't we, to our perhaps especially our treatment of our fellow brothers and sisters who've wronged us and offended us. As we seek to deal with them, we remember who they are. Though they may not have acted like it, we remember they're still one of the Lord's people. They're still a child of God. They're still one for whom the Lord has given his life, and he saved them and redeemed them. And so we're going to treat them with like that. We're going to remember that. Even if they've not acted in that way, we're going to remember that. We're going to treat them with love and respect. Certainly, David treats Saul with great respect, doesn't he? As he makes himself, down in verse 8, look now, as he makes himself known to Saul, as he comes out of the cave, I imagine that Saul's gone some distance. We're not sure of the details, but he bows himself with his face to the earth. Do you see that in verse 8? He stooped with his face to the earth and bowed down. He addresses him as my Lord, the King. He calls him the Lord's anointed. He calls him my father. So Saul has treated David despicably, and yet David speaks to him with the greatest of respect. Wow, there's something, isn't there? And he speaks very graciously to him. He assures him, doesn't he, that in verse 10 and so on, that he's never wanted to take his life. And today he's proved that when he's had an opportunity to do so, and he's just, here it is, it's just the corner of your robe, look. So he deals very graciously with Saul and speaks very honorably to him. But he does speak straight to him, doesn't he? I mean, he is straight with Saul. Look at verse 11. Moreover, my father, see the corner of your robe in my hand, for in that I cut off the corner of your robe and did not kill you. And see that there is neither evil nor rebellion in my hands. I have not sinned against you, yet you hunt my life to take it. Verse 14, after whom has the king of Israel come out? Whom do you pursue, a dead dog, a flea? So, you know, he's straight, look, I haven't tried to kill you, but look what you've done to me. So he faces Saul, doesn't he, with what he's done. And David finishes really by saying in verse 15, therefore, let the Lord be judge and judge between you and me and see and plead my case and deliver me out of your hands. He said something similar, hasn't he, back in verse 12. Let the Lord judge between you and me and let the Lord avenge me on you, but my hand shall not be against you. Here's a secret, isn't it? Behind David's actions. Here's really why he hasn't killed Saul that day, why he hasn't taken matters into his own hands, why he hasn't tried to read his own ideas into providence and take the opportunity to kill Saul, because he's prepared to leave things in God's hands. He knew that the Lord knew what was right and wrong. The Lord knew all that had happened. The Lord knew that he'd restrained his hand. The Lord would judge between them. And he was ready to leave it to the Lord to deal with it. And David contented himself with that. The Lord knows. I can deal with you in this way. I can show grace to you. I can not treat you as you deserve, because this is in the Lord's hands. And he knows. And he will judge. And he does right. And in doing that, let's just turn back again to the New Testament once more, to Romans chapter 12. So will you turn there with me? Romans chapter 12. David is just displaying that attitude that the Apostle Paul exhorts us to show. Romans chapter 12. Let me read from verse 14. Bless those who persecute you. Bless and do not curse. It's the teaching of Jesus again, isn't it? Rejoice with those who rejoice. Weep with those who weep. Be of the same mind toward one another. Do not set your mind on high things, but associate with the humble. Do not be wise in your own opinion. Repay no one evil for evil. Have regard for good things in the sight of all men. If it is possible, as much as depends on you, live peaceably with all men. Beloved, do not avenge yourselves, but rather give place to wrath, for it is written, vengeance is mine. I will repay, says the Lord. Therefore, because that's true, because you can, God will deal, he'll deal with justice. Therefore, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he's thirsty, give him a drink. For in so doing, you will heap coals of fire on his head. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. So when it comes to being personally wronged, we're not to seek to exact revenge ourselves, to make sure we get our pound of flesh. Rather, we're to leave it to the Lord. Remember that God says, vengeance is mine. I'll repay. I'll deal with it. I'm the God of justice. It's not our place to seek revenge. That's God is the judge. He's the avenger. And we can leave things with him. And so what are we to do? We're to meet the needs of our enemies. And to help them, not be overcome by evil, not let it defeat us, not let it eat us up with bitterness and evil and a desire to repay evil with evil, but rather we're to overcome evil with goods. And in doing so, it says, doesn't it, in verse 20 of Romans 12, in doing so, you will heap coals of fire on his head. Now that's not saying, you know, this is the way you get revenge, by making them feel as bad as possible. It's saying, you do that, and by your kindness, they'll be brought to see their ways and be ashamed of themselves. And that's what happens in our passage, isn't it? When Saul sees the way David's acted, the fact he's spared his life, the way he's treated Saul with respect and honor, and the way he's left it to the Lord who knows and sees everything, and the way that David speaks graciously, yes, straight, but graciously with him, Saul is broken. And he's disarmed, at least for a while. So verse 16, back in our passage, the end of the verse, he lifted up his voice and wept. He acknowledges David's righteousness, doesn't he? And his own evil ways. He acknowledges, verse 19, David could have killed him that day. And that would be the usual thing to do. Verse 19, if a man finds his enemy, will he let him get away safely? I mean, not normally, but David has done that. In fact, he acknowledges, doesn't he, in verse 20, that David will be king. And the kingdom will be blessed and established under him. He can see that. He knows that. Even by the way that David has acted. And he acknowledges David is more worthy than him. And he goes home. Now, he'll be back because tragically, his bitterness and jealousy will get the better of him again. But at least for the moment, the way that he's treated him has overcome evil with good. Saul has come to kill him. And he goes away humbled. So here's how to deal with your enemies. Not to take vengeance in your own hands. Leave that with the Lord. Don't act as the world would. Display the same grace that your Heavenly Father has shown to you. It comes back to the gospel again. It comes back to the wonder of God's love and grace to us. That he's dealt with rebels and sinners and wretches with such grace and such compassion and such kindness. And we're to seek with God's grace to be the same. Now, that's not easy, and there are complicated matters perhaps in dealing with some of those things. I recognize that. But here's the principle. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good.